Hello and welcome to the Investors Chronicle Companies and Markets Show. It's been a very, very hot week. We were sweltering in the office on press day, but it was a bit hotter in Greece where all hell has been breaking loose. And we've actually written about that. And we might even talk about it today, mightn't we, Graham?
We might force ourselves to, yeah.
Absolutely. So, joining me today are Graham.
Hello, John.
How you doing?
Good, and you?
Yeah, not too bad, not too bad. James Norrington has written a feature this week looking at UK market valuations. How you doing, James?
Very well, thanks, John. How are you?
Yeah, not too bad, not too bad. A little bit cooler today, so that's nice. Dom over in the control room. Dom Toms, how are you doing, mate?
Doing well, thanks.
Good, good, good. Okay, so yeah, as I said, we're going to talk to James in a minute about the UK equity market valuation. Market Tactics report is written for us this week. Mm-hmm. We're going to talk to Philip Ryland on the phone very shortly about the cover feature, which is getting inside the mind of Warren Buffett. We've got a wonderful piece of Monty Python-esque artwork on
it
the cover.
It is a brilliant cover this week, John.
Yeah, I really Love do that. Like it. I really do like it. He comes up Trump's old Bramjit, our designer sometimes, and this is a corker. We're going to have a little chat. Well, we're not going to have a little chat. I'm just going to tell you, because we've actually done a video this week talking about it, but we've got the tips of the year halfway performance and we are smashing it. So are we not, Graham?
Algy Hall has been dancing around the office this week, our tips editor, on the back of this. We are, really, it's quite impressive.
What have we done? So we have 17.5% absolute performance, 14.1% outperformance.
Yeah.
Because the FTSE All Share has done
2-3%.
Not a great deal. I'll talk about this briefly. Go and watch a video because you'll hear a lot more detail from Algy and a lot of the writers that he's interviewed who've actually written these tips this year. But we've played it safe this year. We had a couple of horror stories last year which really dragged the performance of the tips of the year down. So we played it safe across the board. We went on a real value tip this year. It has to be said, value's not been a great performing strategy over the past few years. But it's working for us so far. I think there's one fund manager in the UK that's beating us, which is extraordinary.
Yeah,
really.
No wonder Algy's been dancing around the office.
Yeah. I think maybe we're not getting paid enough.
Yeah.
But there you go. So that's the third feature. Let's not talk about that. Graham, let's talk news. So we might as well start with Greece. We always say we're not going to talk about it, but it's coming to a head now.
It is coming to a head. Yeah. We spoke about it at some length last week. And then the day after we recorded last week, Alexis Tsipras went out and announced this referendum.
Yeah.
Which took people by surprise a little bit, I think.
But I thought that's because it took people by surprise because the deal that had been offered was off the table. The deal they were voting for was off the table.
Yeah, well, that is the utter confusion around this now, is that the Greek people are being asked to vote yes or no on a very confusing question about something that is no longer an option. So, yeah, where we're going with that, I don't know. But the EU leaders have all been out in force this week and basically telling the Greek people that it's really yes or no as to whether they really want to stay in the Eurozone or not.
Yeah, and Spiros has come out today and said that's essentially blackmail. Blackmail last week, but he's saying, you know, you're basically putting the frighteners on my electorate, and this is outrageous.
And indications are that Tsipras and Varoufakis, the finance minister, Varoufakis has definitely said today that he will resign if there's a yes vote.
But surely he's had enough anyway.
But you would have thought he might be on his way out anyway. And Tsipras, people are sort of saying that he will probably resign if there's a yes. So they're campaigning for no, which the EU is telling them essentially means that you're campaigning to withdraw from the Eurozone.
Yeah, I got to admit, I can't keep up with it. There's not enough hours in the day to put a magazine like the Investors Chronicle together and keep up with the goings on in Greece at the same time. There really isn't.
It has been back and forth all week. It seems to have calmed down a bit today, just because there's nothing. It's sort of EU have said basically they're not going to talk to Greece again until the result of the referendum is known. That's going to be Sunday night, Monday morning. So who knows if there's if there's a no vote, people are saying markets might fall out of bed a bit on Monday morning, but
yeah, my markets have been falling out of bed for several weeks now. Yeah. In fact, I broke my editorial this week about Greece, which I sort of vowed never to do, but I thought, I can't ignore that elephant in the room any longer. I think since when did I say it was? Probably April. The FTSE's down 8%, 7%. The Eurostoxx 50's down 8%. The markets have been falling out of bed for a while.
Oh, yeah.
And they bounced. I think it was yesterday or the day before, because Spiros had said he'll concede some of the demands, but then the European heads had turned around and said, we don't care. It does seem to have got to the point of, basically he said, she said playground politics.
Exactly.
Now. And I can't keep up with it.
No. polls are suggesting that a yes vote will win. You know, it's going to be close still, but polls are suggesting that a yes vote will win. So that means that we're going to be faced with a new government there as well. You know, more uncertainty is going to be the name of the game for if that's the case.
So I mean, you've got uncertainty whether there's a no or a yes, basically. Yeah. Markets don't like that. So, I mean, you know, I think my view, which I've written in the editorial this week, is, you know, that uncertainty is going to dog us for a while. Mm. But what it doesn't mean is that markets are necessarily expensive and due a heavy fall. We'll come on to that in a minute and talk about that with James, because I think that's the crux of your report, particularly with the UK markets. So, okay, let's have a quick look at 7 days. I'm bored of Greece now. let's talk about F1. Because we've got a couple of things here in the magazine. We actually, Dan Liberto went off to have a look at Formula E, which is racing at Battersea Park this
week.
Which
is electric racing.
Electric
cars.
Racing, yes. Yeah. So we've got a nice little blog on that. I mean, the idea behind that is, unlike Formula One, this is technology that potentially translates into road cars. Mm. And so, you know, they're very hopeful that this will, A, you know, attract attention as a serious motor racing sport in its own right, B, attract the attention of, you know, car manufacturers who can genuinely leverage it to prove they've got technology that will make road cars better.
Yeah.
And so you convince people that electric cars don't go at 3 miles an hour and look like those ridiculous things that we see around London that the BBC drive.
But are the electric cars noisy like the F1 cars?
They kind of squeal.
They do squeal.
So yeah, they're kind of nice. I like
added
it.
Added that in, or is that
No,
the
it's
way
real.
Really?
It's real, yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. But then, you know, F1 cars have been criticised this season for not being noisy enough because they changed the engine formula.
Have you?
Yeah, F1's in crisis. But nevertheless...
That noise has always put me off. Awful.
What, the big noise?
Yeah.
Oh, no. People moan that it's not loud enough now.
Really?
Yeah. Because they went to turbos, which make a slightly... they also make a sort of squealing sound.
It's still quite loud, though.
Yeah, not as loud as it used to be. You know, if you're an F1 fan, ridiculous. That's what you're in it for, the noise, mate. You're in it for the noise. But F1 is sort of a bit of a crossroads, both in terms of the sport itself, which I have been following, but I must admit I'm finding increasingly dull. But in terms of the business itself, because, you know, Bernie Ecclestone getting a bit long in the tooth.
Yes.
You know, there's been a lot of talk this week about, you know, a change of ownership.
So that's why CVC may be selling.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I don't know why they might be selling, but... But it is interesting. It's a big sport. Sky have got a big interest in it. They essentially took over coverage of that from the BBC a few years back.
Yep.
They're rumoured to be a buyer.
That's the rumour this week. I mean, over the last weekend, it was the owner of the Miami Dolphins, Stephen Ross, backed by Qatar, was thought to be lining up a deal. And then apparently Sky and maybe Liberty Global could be getting together to do a deal, which would obviously protect Sky's position in terms of broadcasting it. $4.5 billion is the price, pounds, in fact, is the price tag, apparently.
As a fan, if you buy it, sort it out, because it is so dull at the moment. It is beyond belief. The 10 minutes of the electric car racing I watched was much more interesting.
No, see, I know very, very little, very, very little about Formula One. I don't follow it, but I suspect Lewis Hamilton will win the world championship this year.
Well, it's either him or Nico Rosberg.
Predictable?
It's either him or... Team. It's probably going to be Lewis Hamilton. Who knows? Nico Rosberg is a good driver. It's going to be one team, Mercedes. Yeah. That's that. Okay.
Talking of autos, interestingly enough, the figures coming out of the UK automotive industry are quite impressive this week.
Not a surprise.
People equate UK automotive with British Leyland and the like from back in the dark days, but the industry turnover was £69.5 billion last year.
So what are we talking about here? We're not talking about car sales. We're talking about...
Turnover for the auto industry. So we're talking about automotive manufacturer as well as the sort of specialist engineering businesses as well.
Parts businesses. Yeah.
We're also talking about cars that are built on these shores for third-party overseas manufacturers as well.
Okay.
So it's, you know, it is a big UK industry.
It is indeed. I mean, you know, Formula One. Mm. A lot of the teams are based in the UK. I mean, it is a centre of engineering excellence in that respect. And we know, you know, it's a centre of excellence for the more mainstream car industry as well. So that's good. I mean, Dan wrote about this a few weeks back in a cover feature.
Yeah.
What do we call it? Profit machines. So, yeah, UK well represented there. Have a look at that. Planning permission.
Mm.
So I'm getting loft conversions done at the moment. And the beauty of the UK's planning laws is that I can do that without getting planning permission.
Permitted development.
Right. But not quite so simple if you're a fracker or a potash developer.
No, slightly different scale, isn't it?
So we've got two stories here.
Yeah.
That are kind of diametrically opposed in the outcomes.
Mm, exactly. One from Lancashire and one from Yorkshire as well.
Oh.
Yeah. The Lancashire side of the Pennines, the Lancashire County Council knocked back a second application from private shale gas explorer Quadria in the Blackpool area.
This is the one that caused the earthquakes.
The one that widely allegedly caused earthquakes, indeed.
Allegedly. Sorry, allegedly.
So they've been knocked back twice now, which is a bit of a blow to the fracking industry. And there's a couple of quota companies. Centrica's got a stake in Quadria. And also iGas Energy, which is on AIM, has a big acreage of shale prospects across the north. So iGas certainly shares took a bit of a hit this week. So that's bad news for fracking. Over the Pennines in the North York Moors National Park, they've said yes to Sirius Minerals, effectively developing the biggest potash mine in the world, I think.
In the North York Moors National
underneath
Park.
Underneath
the park, yeah.
Underneath the North
York
Moors
underneath
National
it?
Park, yes.
Oh, so it doesn't spoil the beautiful landscape?
Not all of it, no. They're still going to build a mine head, but they will drill down, and it's a huge project. It's unlikely that Sirius themselves are going to still be owners of this by the time it produces potash in several years' time, because it's just too big.
Yeah.
But yeah, they're going to drill down, dig the potash, and then transport it underground for about 35 miles up to Teesside.
Okay. Well, that doesn't sound so bad.
Oh, yeah. Let's wait and see.
Yeah.
Well, okay. The North York Moors National Park people have said yes.
Yeah, well, I mean, that was never a clear-cut outcome for that particular project. And, you know, we've been reasonably negative on it for some time. I had a letter from a reader earlier who has picked us up on our change of view. We've gone to hold, but as I pointed out to him, you know, the facts change, our views have to change with them. Yeah. I think that's the way markets work.
And this has been an emotive stock.
It's emotive.
For a long time. It's
and,
popular.
You know, it's been a coin toss, really. Mm,
yeah, it's been a binary bet. Leading up to this decision on Tuesday, the shares had fallen, you know, from 25p down to 10 or 11, 12, and ticked up a bit, and then they leapt on Wednesday morning. So it's a volatile stock.
Yeah,
but there's a long, long way to go until they get any of this potash out of the ground.
Indeed. So, I mean, you know, planning permission is certainly no guarantee of commercial success over the long term. So, you know, again, I think you have to really qualify your view of this company if you're in it, and, you know, understand how the fundraisings that are going to need to happen might affect your shareholding in the years ahead.
Yeah.
It's certainly not a clear cut winner, even today. And we actually got in trouble with this company a few years back anyway, because we made the unprecedented decision to put a buy and a sell on the same company in the tip section. Such was the difference of opinion on Sirius's prospects
within
the team. And it does happen. You know, we don't all think exactly the same thing all the time. And we got some angry emails about that.
We got a lot of attention for that, didn't we, Tom?
Yeah. I don't regret it.
No.
But I wouldn't do it in the tip section in the future. I think I like these kind of debates. I think these are really healthy to you know, a proper functioning stock market. I think you need to understand both the bull and bear cases. Yeah, if you're buying a share. Sirius, you know, I think you had to understand both sides of that equation.
Yeah, absolutely. And it is an emotive stock, and it has been for many years. And you know, and that sort of debate is healthy within our team. And it's what helps us.
Indeed.
Come to conclusions.
Indeed. I mean, just in terms of Quadrilla, I mean, the whole fracking thing, you know, so we've obviously had this big discovery, Horse Hill, down in the south of England.
The Weald, Sussex.
I mean, you know, is this a reflection of the fears that oil exploration has within the population at large? And does this potentially have a read across to what's going on down in the south coast, do you think?
It may well do. I mean, there was a great deal of local opposition in the Preston and Blackpool area to this. And the plans were knocked back specifically on the impact on the local landscape and noise impact on local communities.
Yeah.
And that is not going to be any different in the Sussex Weald, is it?
No.
So,
no.
Yeah.
And of course,
wonder.
We've also had the discussions about airports this week, as in both that region and obviously the west of London as well. So, yeah, I mean, NIMBYism is alive and well, and, you know.
Certainly is. Always will be, John.
Absolutely. Always and obviously, the other big news story this week, the tragic news story, obviously, what's happened in Tunisia, which has obviously had a big hit on the tour operators who are unfortunately involved in the terrorism out there.
Horrible, yes.
Really horrible. And Greece has had an impact too on the travel businesses.
I think
people are nervous about going there, and it's obviously a big holiday destination.
Yeah, so. And then there's been big weakness in the travel stocks over the past week. Tunisian event, and it certainly didn't help. And it just proves that, you know, sometimes people were saying, "Oh, these stocks look cheap," when they were trading up so these events are sort of like mid to high single digit PEs, but really, you know, they are that price for a reason, because they are susceptible to external factors at any time.
There was a similar atrocity in Tunisia a while back that, you know, didn't involve British tourists, but nevertheless scared tourists off. And, you know, I think the evidence, the history suggests that it takes a long time for particular countries to recover from these kind of things.
Indeed,
I mean, for a tour operator, I guess they can sort of siphon off their customers into different destinations, but nevertheless, I think the sentiment gets pounding.
At this stage of the season, you know, we're pretty much at the summer peak now. I mean, it's difficult to change your capacity that quickly, I would imagine.
But indeed. Yeah. I'm going to the Lake District.
I'm going to Norway.
Norway? Nice.
Yeah.
Wow. No, I don't know what to say there. Where about you? Don't go to Lillehammer, are you?
No, we're not. No.
Okay. No, we've had enough Lillehammer on this podcast. All right. Okay, that's the news. James, let's talk valuations, because you've crunched the numbers this week, and the conclusion is UK equities not looking too bad after all.
Yeah, to start off with, caveat heavily that a big shock could come in at any time.
But you can't account for that.
You can't account for that stuff. But just based on looking at past valuations, on a number of metrics that have been historically quite closely correlated with future returns, it doesn't look cheap, but it certainly doesn't look expensive. Basically, you know, if you're going to lose money on the stock market, it's not because it's overpriced now. It's because there's going to be some external factor.
What, like Greece?
like Greece, for example.
Although I think the general view that we expressed in the magazine this week is that Greece, in and of itself, is not going to be that external factor that knocks valuations for six. China, that's a different story altogether. We haven't really written about this week.
No, the only mention we had of China was in the numbers on the 7 days page. The Shanghai Composite's down 21%
in a week.
No, 3 weeks.
3 weeks. Oh, right, that's all right then. sorry, James. So tell us about the metrics that you look at that you think give us the clearest view of how UK equity valuations stack up against their historic norms.
In this report, I looked at UK equities in isolation. I think you'd want to look at them against other asset classes as well. You want to look at your risk premium.
But sounds like someone's right about the future.
Yes, well, that's I've mentioned that at the foot of the feature.
Looking forward to it.
So it was an interesting exercise, but it left me with a few questions. But for the FTSE 100, so I looked at, based on the R squared, so the correlation coefficient. Of various data points of annualized future returns on a 1 year, 3 year, and 7 year basis for the FTSE 100 and the FTSE All Share with various metrics, and they were based on a market tactics report that Dominic Picarda did over a year ago, and I just selected the ones which he'd found most relevant at the time. So I looked at the forward PE ratio, dividend yield, and price to peak earnings for FTSE 100, and for the FTSE All Share, dividend yield again, CAPE, cyclically adjusted price earnings ratio, and price to book.
Yeah, price to book. I think that's the one you mentioned has the closest correlation with
for the FTSE All Share.
For the FTSE All Share,
yeah, not so much. It wasn't so predictive for the 100.
Okay, so what's it telling us exactly? What sort of returns can we be looking forward to based on where these metrics sit? And you know, is there any of those that are looking particularly expensive or cheap?
Well, it varies. So the price to book, actually, it suggests that the All Share is it's the most predictive. It's got the highest level of correlation with returns in the past. That's suggesting sort of a double digit gains over the 16% over 3 year period, and 7.5 over 7 year period, which is perhaps on the high side. But remember, we're looking at historical, and it's slightly skewed. Well, I think it's quite a lot skewed by what happened, you know, prior to the .com boom.
Yeah, and so those they're annualized returns.
They're annualized returns. So yeah,
you know, 16.5% a year for 3 years, based on where that the level of price to book.
Yes, I don't see that happening, to be honest.
No, no, but it's a comfort factor.
Yeah. I mean, what I've done is I've actually, based on the predictiveness, based on the correlation coefficient, I've attached a weighting to each metric to give sort of a dirty average for the FTSE 100 and for the FTSE All Share. PB has been obviously the most predictive for the All Share, so that actually pulls the overall average for that up. But so the dirty average we've got here, we're looking at sort of 11% every year for 3 years for the All Share,
okay,
and 7% a year over 7 years. So that's possibly, you know, a bit optimistic, but not you know, totally outlandish either.
Okay, so let's talk about dividend yield. It's one that interests me, interests a lot of our readers, because you know, a lot of readers are interested in the income aspects of equities, but dividend yield can also be a good indicator of future returns.
Well,
it's
you know, it's fundamentally, it's the premium that when an investor looks at their return, it's one of the premiums they look at for how they value a share. So it's going to be correlated with value, and it is in fact it's one of the methods for looking at, you know, equity risk premium as well. Dividend yield. So for the FTSE 100, very predictive.
And what's it saying?
It's saying for the FTSE 100 that based you know, at the start of June when I ran the data, with a div yield of 3.48%
on the index as a whole.
On the index of the whole FTSE 100, the average. You know, we're looking at over three years, annualized real returns in the region of 7.5%. Over the 7-year outlook, that's smooth out to 3.6% a year.
But that doesn't sound a lot. That doesn't sound a lot, but that's kind of, that's norms, really.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of private investors in particular overestimate the amount you could actually expect in the way of total returns every year. So 3.6% a year doesn't sound a lot, but it's actually, you know, pretty standard.
That, then,
when you compound that and reinvest those dividends, it actually...
And those are real returns as well. So so that is adjusting for inflation already. So
Okay.
So that's... If it does seem a little on the low side for people who invest in the stock market to beat inflation, that was included in the numbers.
Yeah, okay. All right, interesting. Yeah. So, you know, I'd suggest you go away and have a read of that, because, you know, really get a feel for where the markets are in valuation terms. I think we ought to go away and have a look at some other markets and see what they stack up historically, because the US is looking a bit pricier.
That's, you know, again, as we talk about external factors, the US, for example, on a the cyclically adjusted price earnings ratio, you know, that's looking very toppy, sort of around 26, 27, something like that, which is over its historic highs. But the thing is, you know, CAPE, it's criticised as a bit of a blunt instrument, been overpriced for a year, and how many US professional investors, you know, they were saying to their clients that they'd got out of the markets looking expensive last year, they'd have missed bumper returns. And
run your profits. Your profits.
Yeah, basically. So I think the takeaway from this really is it was an interesting exercise. The valuations, it can inform you of tactical asset allocation, but actually, you know, stay in the market over the longer term. It wouldn't be using this to time getting in and out. It's sort of setting allocations, looking at your objectives and what sort of mix to achieve that with the least level of risk, which is, you know, one of the things I'll be looking at next.
Yeah, no, good. Well, thank you for that, James. I mean, it does give us a crumb of comfort when we're looking at a situation like China or Greece or, you know, wherever else there's trouble in the world, and that's pretty much everywhere all the time, and it always has been. So, I think if we can, you know, ground our investment outlook in these kind of reports and these kind of figures, then I think it's helpful, and I think it's reassuring, and I think it proves what we at the IC believe, which is that this is a long-term game, and play it sensibly.
Don't panic.
Wonderful. All right, thanks, James. And now we're going to move on to this week's cover feature, which is written by Philip Ryland, who's joining us on the telephone. Hello, Philip.
Hi, John.
How are you?
I'm pretty good.
Yeah, enjoying the tennis?
It was pretty warm, but yeah, I did enjoy it.
Oh, you went to the tennis? I didn't realise you'd been.
Yeah, I was baking on number one court.
Yesterday?
Yeah.
Wow, it was so hot.
Ouch. It was, you're right.
Yeah, okay. Well, good stuff. So, this week's feature, it's about Warren Buffett.
It is indeed.
Well, it's sort of about Warren Buffett, because as you say, it's a bit odd. We're sort of talking about Berkshire Hathaway, more perhaps than we're talking about Warren Buffett, but trying to get a glimpse into his mind to understand how he's built up such a successful business. So perhaps give us the premise of the feature and, you know, why you wrote it.
Partly because I'm, like so many people, I'm fascinated with Buffett. The peg of the feature was that Buffett gets written about an awful lot as if he's basically an investor. What we tend to forget is that he's built up, the third biggest company in the United States by market capitalization. So really, he's a businessman. He's not an investor. He's a businessman. Now, he might say, well, you know, the two are one and the same. But it seems to me that Berkshire Hathaway tends to get forgotten about a little bit while we all focus on Warren Buffett.
So we'll know him for his investments in things like Tesco and Kraft, but Berkshire Hathaway is a very different beast altogether.
Berkshire Hathaway is a different beast altogether. It started out as a vehicle for buying parts of businesses, and has ended up more as a huge conglomerate for buying whole businesses. So the investments for which he's famous, maybe he's infamous for Tesco, but he's famous for things like spotting American Express at the bottom, buying Coca-Cola, Procter & Gamble, that sort of thing. So he's famous for these brilliant long-term investments. But his biggest achievement is to build up Berkshire Hathaway, and proof of that, I guess, is that the long-term investments only account for about 20% of Berkshire's $500 billion worth of assets. Can you believe? And the 80%, the rest of it, is a number of huge businesses, many of which, eight of which, if they were standalone companies, could get into the Fortune 500 just by themselves.
Okay, and the interesting thing, I guess, about Buffett's businesses are that the way he's been able to acquire them is, so he began by buying textile mills, which he admits himself was a disaster, mm-hmm. but then he went on to buying something altogether different, and that's really what's behind the success of Berkshire Hathaway.
The success of Berkshire Hathaway was that he started out as a value investor, basically trying to buy low-quality companies where there was a quick profit to be had. And that was the story of Berkshire Hathaway, which was a languishing textiles company. And then somewhere along the way, with the help most likely, of his vice chairman, a guy called Charlie Munger, who's less well-known than Buffett, but he's very important, somewhere along the way, Buffett kind of transformed his approach from, as I think he has said, was the effect that, you know, you should stop trying to buy ordinary businesses at wonderful prices, and buy wonderful businesses at ordinary prices or at fair prices. So the focus became the quality of the business, high quality businesses, which could be expected to produce reliable long-term cash flows.
Okay. How could he afford to do that, though? And this was the thing that struck me when I looked at Warren Buffett a few years back for an editorial I wrote. Everyone tries to emulate him. There's so many books out there that say, oh, you can be like Buffett, invest like Warren Buffett. But actually, the thing that he has that I think a lot of people who try and emulate him don't have is enormous pots of cash to work with. And it was his foray into insurance that have really underpinned that.
Yeah, but kind of he did that because, you know, he's smarter than the average investor. At an early stage, I think he realized the wonderful possibilities of running an insurance company, because, you know, the thing that insurance companies have, this magical thing, is their float, is the premiums that they're paid up front in advance of having to pay out claims. And, you know, that float it's a lot of capital, and if the insurance company is making underwriting profits, in other words, if in any given year the claims are less than the premiums, then the float, which is a pot of capital, effectively comes free. And, you know, this is the important thing that Buffett twigged early on. Even while he was still a cigar butt investor, as it were, he became aware of the potential of having an insurance operation within his overall operations. So that's what gave him his capital to begin with. And it started giving him so much capital that rather than buy bits of companies, in a way, he had little choice but to buy the whole companies because there was so much capital and he was becoming so successful so quickly.
Absolutely. Okay, so the lesson there is if you can, buy an insurance company. But, you know, what he has essentially built, and I mean, this is sort of the antithesis of sort of modern business school thinking about how you build a large business. He's built a conglomerate. And, you know, we know going back to the 70s and 80s, conglomerates were quite popular and fell apart for various reasons. And you know, he has made it a success. But I think, you know, you refer in the feature to actually what's going to happen to Berkshire Hathaway after Warren Buffett retires. And you know, it's perhaps the success he's had in building a conglomerate structure, which is why we should perhaps worry about the future of Berkshire Hathaway as well.
Well, absolutely, yeah. Conglomerates, as we know, conglomerates get a bad press. In the hands of Warren Buffett, however, conglomerates aren't necessarily bad. If you think of a conglomerate basically as an enlarged investment portfolio, whereby rather than buying bits of the company, you buy the whole company, then the logic kind of hangs together. But it only hangs together if you're as good as Buffett. So Berkshire Hathaway hung together brilliantly, does hang together brilliantly while Buffett is in charge.
And is this a cultural thing? Is it something, you know, unique to Buffett that has allowed him to manage a conglomerate structure effectively?
Cultural to the extent that if you believe what Warren Buffett says, Buffett and Munger put a big emphasis on this notion of trust, mm. on this notion of liking the people you're doing business with, liking the people who you hire as managers. I mean, there's a quote in the feature, and it's a fairly well-known quote, I think, where Munger talks about running Berkshire on a seamless web of trust, isn't it?
Mm.
Munger also says quite rightly that, I'm quoting here because I'm looking at the quote, he says that good character is very efficient. If you can trust people, your systems can be way simpler, way more simple, which means they can be cheap. So, you know, if you have good people and they like working for you and you like them and you give them lots of autonomy and you pay them well and blah-de-blah, then the whole thing can work wonderfully. But one is never quite sure to what extent it's cause and to what extent it's effect. So I'm never really quite sure to the extent that Buffett has now become a cheerleader for his businesses.
Mm.
And indeed, one asks the question, well, are the businesses really quite as good now as he says they are? And that's partly because the nature of Berkshire Hathaway has changed in the past, five years, 10 years certainly, but maybe even 5 years, when it's moved, it's much more of a utility now than it ever used to be. It still has brilliant companies in there, but the brilliant companies are fewer and further between. And now, basically, it's three business streams. It's an insurance company. It's a freight train company, and it's a provider of a power supply company.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I was fascinated by the point you make about how much of Buffett's success is not actually down to Buffett, but good luck. His sort of timing, the 50 years in which he's been running Berkshire being, you know, a golden era for the US economy. And he's simply, you know, ridden along with that. You know, I find these things quite fascinating because they're sort of philosophical in when it comes to investment.
Well, yeah, I mean, Munger talks about these. Munger focuses on these four factors that made Buffett and Berkshire great. And one of them was, he talks about the constructive peculiarities of Buffett, which I think basically is another way of saying that Buffett is a genius, and we shouldn't forget that. Then he talks about the constructive peculiarities of Berkshire, and that's basically about Buffett's decision to build a conglomerate around insurance company operations. Then Munger also talks about good luck. But, you know, look, in talking about that good luck, I'm looking at the figure now that in the 50 years that Buffett has run Berkshire, the tailwind that the U.S. stock market provided was a compound growth rate of 9.9% a year. Okay, that's pretty good, damn good. But in that period, and we're talking about a 50-year period now, Buffett has managed to get twice that rate. So, okay, the market has been a substantial factor in his favor. But, you know, you just start compounding the difference between, in round terms, 10% and 20% over 50 years and see how much extra you end up with.
Yeah,
so,
a lot.
You know, we kind of... One shouldn't ignore good luck. Good luck is always a big factor, but there does seem to be something rather special about Buffett and Berkshire.
Mm, absolutely, and as I said, I think that's why you're perhaps concerned that when he and Charlie Munger retire, things might change a bit, and perhaps it will start to look
retire, John.
Retire. perhaps the, you know, the business will go down more the lines that, you know, we're more used to large businesses being run, teams of consultants and non-execs, and you know, the specialness of it will disappear.
Yeah, well, we know it won't get better. I mean, in a sense, it can't get better. We know it can't get better. If it gets bigger, it will get slower. But meanwhile, in the absence of Buffett, it won't be easier. It's a bit like, you know, the analogy, I suppose, would be Manchester United after Alex Ferguson, only multiplied 1,000 times. It's that sort of scale. When someone as influential as Buffett leaves the business, it simply can't get better. So the best it can do is stay on track. But the likelihood is it's going to get worse, especially when you think that, you know, there are all sorts of reasons why it could get worse.
Absolutely. Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you, Philip. As I said, it's a fascinating feature. I really enjoy reading it. It's not the usual. It's not our usual fare at all. But it is a really interesting way of thinking about companies and the way they run. So thank you very much, Philip.
Thanks for those kind words, Sean.
Thank you.
Toodaloo.
Okay. So that, I think, pretty much covers what we want to talk about on today's podcast. There is, of course, plenty more in the magazine, as I say every week. I'm not going to start banging the desk on, don't worry. Lots of results, not as many as there have been for some weeks, but we're still pretty busy. Personal finance section, stuffed full of good stuff as usual, and they will be talking about that on their podcast tomorrow. Pick it up. You won't miss the cover. It's very unusual. Bit of Monty Python meets Roy Lichtenstein. All good news agents, £4.50, and we'll chat again next week. Thanks a lot. Goodbye.
When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. Make a bigger impact at work with Grammarly. Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. You can even save time by going from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds. Join the 96% of Grammarly users that say it helps them craft more impactful writing. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done.